The Accidental Spy is the extraordinary true story of how an ordinary man became the most successful spy in modern history. Through unprecedented interview access to David Rupert, The Accidental Spy reveals the gripping inside story of the American trucker who made $10 million working for the FBI and MI5 to bring down a deadly terrorist organization, the real IRA. Here to tell us more about it is the man who wrote the book himself, Sean O'Driscoll. Sean, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So tell me a little bit about the background to what the situation was in Northern Ireland at the time and who the real IRA were as opposed to the provisional or the continuity IRA.
Well, the provisional IRA were the main IRA, you know, there were 90% of it, and they were obviously had a very big campaign against Britain of bombings and shootings. And then it looked like there was going to be a peace agreement in 1987. So part of them broke away and called themselves the real IRA, which were really the deadliest part of the IRA, the people, the real diehards, the ones who absolutely weren't going to give up. And they were just going to continue on with the bombings and the shootings indefinitely.
And so how difficult was it for the intelligence services or the security services to get somebody inside these groups? Were they? I would imagine they would be brutally hard to infiltrate.
Absolutely. They're very suspicious of outsiders. And I think the book chronicles a lot of cases where they tried to get in with deadly consequences. You know, anybody who was suspected of an informer was executed. And they never hid that, you know. Sinn Féin leaders like Martin McGuinness would come on TV and say, well, you know, that's the price you pay if you're going to be an informer. It was a very, very dangerous atmosphere.
And so then, therefore, it's a little bit surprising about the man who actually managed to get into the real IRA, because he wouldn't strike one at first sight as the sort of person who would even be interested in what was happening in the provinces.
No, I mean, before he got into all of this, I don't think he could even have pointed out Ireland on a map. He's a trucker from upstate New York, 6'7", 300 pounds. But he just happened to meet a woman in a bar in Florida, and he was trying to impress her. It turned out that she was a fundraiser for NARAID, the IRA's political wing. She was also very high up in the Democratic Party in Florida. And he was just trying to chat her up, really, and just, you know, oh, yeah, I know about Ireland. And they started dating, and then she invited him over to Ireland, and then he got to know some of her friends up in the northwest of Ireland. And little by little, he started to know them a bit better. But he didn't know that the Irish anti-terrorist police were taking photographs of him and wondering who he was. And then they passed it on to the FBI in Chicago.
So how did they make this the first approach then? Because, I mean, a lot of Americans go over to Ireland and they meet family and meet friends. So why in particular? But obviously the Irish special branch was presumably shadowing these guys.
They were, yeah. It was a very, very critical time when he went over, and the IRA had declared ceasefire for the first time. It looked like there was a real chance of peace, but yet there was a substantial amount of them that were willing to break away. So the special branch had them under very, very tight surveillance. And this, you know, huge American guy just kept reappearing and reappearing up in the northwest with some very dangerous people. So they just started taking photographs of him, particularly outside one particular hotel where he was staying. And then they passed those photographs on to the FBI, wondering who is this guy and what's he about.
And, I mean, what did the FBI say? I mean, did they make him, as the parlance goes, an offer he couldn't refuse? Or did he think, did he realize what he was getting into?
They played a pretty smart game. You know, they just came in and they, you know, at first they were kind of aggressive. They came into his trucking company with photographs from Ireland. And you know, he said, look, I've got nothing to say. Then they came back again. And then he was like, look, I've done nothing wrong. I just met these people. Then they came back a third time and they're like, why don't we just pay for your holidays in Ireland? You go over to Ireland, you don't have to tell us anything, just let us pay for your holidays. So at this stage, he had found his wife, his fourth wife, and he said, look, I'm going to sucker the FBI into paying for my holidays. She said, okay. And then off they went. But, you know, once you have crossed that line, then it's very easy for the FBI to come back and say, do you know this person? Do you know that person? By bit, they got him in until he was totally convinced.
And not only that, but they to help him with his cover story, they went to the extraordinary thing of buying him a pub.
Yeah, they paid for the lease on a pub in Ireland, right on the border. So it was the perfect location. A lot of IRA people were coming in and out of the bar. He was a novelty in the area, you know, in a rural pub like that. A lot of people want to know him and want to talk. So he was listening the whole time. And then he began emailing back to the FBI, a process that would begin. It would take 2,300 emails, just constantly back and forth. And a lot of big IRA people were coming in and out. And he was also kind of establishing a base and getting to know the dissidents, the ones who were breaking away, going to their political meetings, just getting his face seen.
All this is obviously mid-90s. 1998, the horrendous Omar bombing takes place, and obviously the security sources need to step up their game. What was the reaction, and what effect did it have on David Rupert?
Had a huge effect on him. He was actually in Ireland at the time of the bombing. He'd just gone for a hike with his wife, and then he went over to the pub of one of the dissident leaders, a guy called Joe O'Neill. And Joe said, you know, you better leave the country straight away. So David called his contacts and left the country. But it was a defining moment to see. There was 29 killed. Well, 31, most people would say. The majority of those were teenagers and children. So it kind of took it to another level completely. You know, some of these guys were kind of pub singers and so on. But I think Oma really, really sharpened in Rupert's mind just what he was dealing with here. Because some of the people he met in the real IRA, it didn't seem to bother them in the slightest that they had killed so many civilians. It was simply a setback that they had to get over.
Mm. And of course, one of the things that he'd been asked to do, to bring over from the States, would be bomb-making materials and bomb-making equipment.
Yes, they had what they call an engineering department, and they were very, very good engineers. They wanted very, very sophisticated equipment to make the newest range of bomb. In the book, I kind of wrote about, like, there was kind of this competition between them who could build the most sophisticated devices. So they were always looking for, you know, Bluetooth device, or they were looking for that, you know, the Sims game, because there was a certain type of chip on it that they needed. They were constantly looking for the latest stuff from America, online digital planners, all kinds of things for long delay bombs. So he was kind of their conduit to the States. But his dilemma really was that the FBI did not want him getting involved in illegal acts. They didn't want him buying bomb equipment. So that put him in a terribly dangerous situation, in that the real IRA were meeting with him, giving him long shopping lists of things he had to buy in America. And he was really wondering how long he could last without getting into bomb-making business.
Mm. How did he manage not to... I mean, I'm just trying to imagine the amount of pressure he must have been under, and the date of going about his day-to-day business not to be revealed. You said before that the IRA were notorious for dealing with anybody they thought was an infiltrator. How on earth did he manage to keep this pretense up? And did he not be challenged at any time whatsoever?
Yeah, there were some very, very scary moments. At one engineering meeting, he gave them encrypted software that had come through MI5. They didn't know that, of course, but one of them got very suspicious about this encrypted software and then challenged him and said, you know, how do we know that this hasn't been tampered with? How do we know where this came from? And luckily for him, I mean, he said it was the scariest moment of his life. The leader of the real IRA, a guy called Mickey McKevitt, intervened between David Rupert and the bomb maker and told them both to calm down. And then afterwards told David Rupert, well done for standing up to that engineer. You know, if that was me, I would have told him what to do and all this kind of thing. That was a very, very scary moment. There was other ones as well. I mean, there was a bizarre coincidence where a new book about Hillary Clinton had come out, and it talked about her first boyfriend, whose name was David Rupert, from upstate New York, you know, that she lost her virginity with and all this kind of thing. So then one of them saw a newspaper article about this book, saw that Hillary Clinton was dating this guy called David Rupert from upstate New York, and then challenged him, shouting at him, and said, you know, you're working for the U.S. government. You were Hillary Clinton's boyfriend. This is all about the peace process. And he's like, no, no, no. So he took the newspaper and made a joke out of it. You know, he literally said, like, I did a lot of things in my life, but Hillary Clinton wasn't one of them. And then the guy kind of started laughing, and he managed to defuse the situation. But there was a lot of scrapes like that.
Mm. And also, we're thinking, because no terrorist group can survive without funding. I mean, we were talking about NORAD at the beginning, which was the fundraising division of the Provisional IRA. when the Provost stopped operating as a terrorist organisation per se, the real IRA had to look further afield for their financing, and they went to name, you know, obviously many of us associate with terrorism as well.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, he talks about how that was the key for him. I mean, a lot of people wondered, how did this non-Irish-American manage to infiltrate so deeply? Well, he was bringing the fundraising money over from Chicago. They would have raffles. They would have all kinds of, you know, dances and things like that. They would raise money, and they didn't want to leave electronic record of their funding for the real IRA. So he was going over a few times a year, so they would just give him the money in the envelope. And every time he arrived, he would give them 10 grand. So that was really his way in. I mean, he was always welcome, you know. Every time he came into the room, he just hand over an envelope. So that was really, that opened all doors, really.
And also, what was the situation with, because the Provisional IRA had been funded by Gaddafi before then, and now they were back on the international market looking for another enemy of the UK to step in with the funding.
That's right. Gaddafi had made overtures to Tony Blair, and he had already supplied the Provisional IRA with more than 100 tons of equipment. All of their Semtex came from Gaddafi. So he didn't want to have anything to do with the real IRA, so they urgently needed somebody. So then Mickey McKevitt, the leader of the real IRA, said to Rupert that he really needs a foreign sponsor, and suggested Saddam Hussein might be able to replace Gaddafi. So then David Rupert went to MI5 and told them this. So then they immediately began this process of setting up a sting operation where they got Arab agents who had come over from Iraq to impersonate Iraqi government agents who were willing to help the real IRA and give them millions of dollars and give them loads of plastic explosives and surface-to-air missiles and all kinds of things. And bit by bit, they got totally suckered into it, but they had no idea that it was actually MI5 and that they were recording every conversation.
And obviously, no, David. The David was married, of course, at this point, and his wife Maureen was obviously not existing in a vacuum. How was she managing to keep up the pretense of her husband being a supporter of the organisation?
Well, it was tough for her with her family, who were Irish American and who would have been implacably opposed to the IRA, because they, as far as her family were concerned, David was somehow connected to the IRA, and they didn't like that one bit. But she couldn't tell them that David was actually working for the FBI until the very end. But when she was in Ireland, she played an excellent game. You know, she met with very, very senior dissident IRA people. She met with Mickey McKevitt's wife, Bernadette, who is Bobby Sands' sister, you know, the IRA's biggest martyr. They went, the four of them went out for dinner together. You know, Maureen just like really bonded with her. She was in and out of the house of many dissident leaders. And in fact, you know, one of the IRA leaders I spoke to, I mean, to this day, he just could not believe that Maureen had anything to do with this. But she was actually taking every time David left a meeting, Maureen would take all the notes as he spoke, and then they would send it to MI5 or the FBI and then burn the notes. But he didn't know, this IRA leader I spoke to, he didn't know any of that, and he just couldn't accept that she had anything to do with it, because she's so bubbly and outgoing and friendly. He just found it hard to believe.
And of course, Mickey McKevitt really sort of took David to heart and protected him. And in all the, we've seen this so many times, when it actually came to the time when McKevitt's house was raided, I don't think he could possibly believe that David Rupert was working for MI5 and the FBI.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you get the transcript of the interview when he's taken to the police station and you know, he's asked so many questions, and then the conversation keeps coming back to David Rupert, and he'd been interviewed and arrested many times before, of course, but he would just pick a spot in the wall and stay silent. But this time he started talking, and then, you know, you can sense in the transcript the awkwardness and the fear he was starting to feel as they kept on returning to David Rupert. And one of the police officers who interviewed him told me that he was really surprised that Mickey McKevitt started talking. But I think he was stunned that they kept bringing back David Rupert, and he kept on denying he knew David Rupert. But it got him talking, because he clearly realized that something very bad had happened.
And what was the reaction like in Ireland then, and the province when, you know, McKevitt goes on trial? I mean, it must have been one of the biggest trials of its type in the history.
Absolutely. I covered the Special Criminal Court, which is a terrorist court, for many years, and I never saw anything like it. I mean, it was absolutely huge. You know, journalists came over from Britain, from America for it. And then the courtroom was packed out every day, and David went through the longest cross-examination in Irish legal history. You know, the defense had sent over private detectives to America to get information on him. Obviously, IRA leaders who knew anything about him would try and discredit him. So the trial went on and on and on. But the media interest, you know, was sustained throughout. There was always TV cameras outside. It was a very, very big case.
And also, it had, as these cases often have, a moment of high drama with the two former friends facing each other across the courtyard, across the courtroom, excuse me.
Absolutely, yeah. And the last time they saw each other was when they went out for a meal, and Mickey McKevitt wished him the very best luck in America and said, you know, give me a shout as soon as you're back. And they waved each other goodbye, and then next time they meet, it's in the courtroom, and he's looking across, and, you know, when he took the witness stand, the prosecutor said, just for the record, can you identify the defendant, Mickey McKevitt? And he had to point across the courtroom at him and just say that that's him between the two police officers. And McKevitt had been primed for this moment, so he didn't react. He just stared back at him and stayed staring.
McKevitt was jailed for 20 years. How much of a body blow to the organization was his incarceration?
It was a huge body blow to them because he was the quartermaster general in charge of the Provisional IRA initially. In other words, he was in charge of all of their weapons and all of their bomb-making equipment. Most of it was stored in farms south of the border, and he knew where all their weapons were. So when the split came, he was able to take the best of the weapons with him. He also, you know, he was a hardened guy who had a little experience. So without him, the organization started to split apart, really. It needed somebody like him in charge, so decided to fracture pretty quickly after he went to prison.
And what was, I mean, what happened next then with David Rupert? I mean, he was obviously under massive amounts of protection. He presumably false identity and disappeared from the scene.
Yeah, he and Maureen were taken by the FBI to an office where they were given a whole new identity. It was a military background. You know, on paper, they are military veterans, the pair of them. New names, new everything. But, you know, among friends and family, they're the same two people, but you'd never find them on paper because, you know, they're every legal document, every electricity bill, every phone bill is under a different name. And the FBI have kept very close eye on security. For example, Maureen's daughter, she got a threatening phone call from a guy who said that he would kill her and her family if David testified. So for 3 months, the FBI escorted her to work every day. They really tried their utmost to keep up security.
I mean, how willing was David to speak to you about this? I mean, did he want his story to be told? Did he want to come forward and talk about what he'd been through, or did you decide the time was right to put the book together?
Initially, he was a little reluctant because he'd been burned a few times before by journalists, you know, who said they wanted to tell his story, but actually they were looking for something else. For example, you know, one guy said that he wanted to write a book about the experience, but actually all he was trying to make a documentary and, you know, really serious about it. Then a few other journalists in America pulled out of the project because I don't think they could really understand it. Unless you're British or Irish, I think it's hard to get your head around quite what's going on, you know. So I said to him, you know, I'm Irish, I lived through this, you know, I interviewed these people before, I know this world. You don't need to explain much to me if you just trust me. And he did, you know, and he was far more talkative than I thought he would be. And he had a very, very good memory. And there was, of course, the 2,300 emails with the FBI and MI5, which helped enormously. And then, as it turned out, Maureen kept an absolutely excellent diary, which really, really helped, especially when they went on the run. You know, once the Sunday Times had named them in Ireland, then they disappeared from their house very quickly. And Maureen just kept such a minute diary of all their time of that year. Getting ready for trial and everywhere they went in America, and you know, that really added to it too.
Also, you've said that you hope the book would raise some uncomfortable questions for security forces in the US, Ireland, and the UK. What particular questions do you want raised?
I thought some of the security lapses and the internal rivalry is quite shocking, actually. I mean, there was one point where David was with a very senior Real IRA guy who came over to America to sell David to Real IRA supporters as, this is our guy, this is the guy you go to. And the FBI kept him under surveillance in Chicago, and David was wearing a wire. He was wearing a bugging device to record this guy. But the FBI in Chicago had said, when you're driving him to New York, you must switch off the bugging device before you cross the New York border. Otherwise, we'll have to tell the New York FBI office that we're involved in this, and we don't want them involved. And that kind of shocked me, because as he was driving towards New York border, the guy was talking about how to make explosives. He was talking about the different types of fertilizer you need for car bombs. Very, very incriminating stuff. But David had to pull in at a filling station, go to the bathroom, switch off the recording device, get back in the car, and bring this guy to New York, all because of internal FBI rivalry. You know, you consider that conversation happened just a few months before 9/11. You see how these lack of cooperation, even internally, can really hurt security.
And if you also, because perhaps we all think that terrorist organizations are brought down by people leaping in through windows and you know, capturing knocks on the door in the middle of the night, but you said the quiet patience it takes to bring it to an end.
Yeah, I think the MI5 are willing to play a very long game on this. You know, they've been monitoring monitoring McKevitt for decades. In fact, when he went to MI5 headquarters in London, one of their senior agents, you know, set Rupert down, and I like, couldn't believe that he'd been with McKevitt, because this guy had been quietly watching McKevitt for so many years. And I thought they did a good job, actually, of just very, very quietly getting Rupert in there, not pushing too much, not getting too much information. You can see that in the emails. They're very much letting Rupert just run the show. He's a trucker. He knows their world. He's not going to be doing anything. Whereas Rupert, I felt with the FBI, you know, they were kind of doing a very FBI kind of way. Like, they wanted him to rent a yacht and then take McKevitt and his wife out in a yacht and then bug the yacht. You know, just like straight out of some sort of like Florida drug bust movie, you know. And he said, absolutely no way. I don't do that. That would raise immediate suspicions. It's not something I do. If I said, if I owned a yacht and I went out every day, maybe, but I don't. But yeah, MI5, they're very, very good at kind of just staying in the background, not pushing too much, and just seeing how things play out.
What's David Rupert like now then? I mean, is he a man content? Is he happy from what? I mean, he made $10 million US out of this thing. I mean, is he a content man? Is he a worried man? Do you think he is, you know, at peace with himself and the world?
I think so. I mean, in the beginning he wasn't. The beginning, he was an emotional, absolute mess after all of this. But it took him some time to just really calm down and come away from it. And I think he and Maureen are two very, very happy people. I think that they're very relaxed. They have a good life. They're not under financial pressure. They travel. They have a good time. You know, the security business is always in the background. There was a serious attempt by the Real IRA to get him. In 2008, it was one of their was in prison in Northern Ireland. There was an Irish American supporter who visited him in prison, and the Real IRA leader had asked to get David's real social security number. Could this guy help out with finding it so that they could shoot him? But PSNI got word of it and then contacted the FBI. So then David was able to improve his security. So, I mean, it's there, but he tries not to let it interfere too much in his life.
I mean, if you think about it, it's a highly unlikely story about, you know, a New York trucker who wanders over into a bar because he likes the sounds of some music, sees a beautiful woman, and over the course of events that set off, bring down one of the most feared terrorist groups in Europe.
Absolutely. I mean, that's more than anything else, that was what attracted me to the story. The fact that this guy knew nothing about Ireland, he wasn't even trying to know anything about Ireland. He, you know, heard some music, traditional music in a bar, wandered over, meets beautiful woman, and then gets drunk and knows nothing about. That that to me was the core of the story. That was what fascinated me, you know, the fact that this guy didn't grow up in our world and just was thrown into it and kind of just winged his way through it.
The book is called The Accidental Spy. It's by Sean O'Driscoll. It's out now on Mirror Books. Sean, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, can they find you online? Is there a social media presence? Is there a website?
Yeah, Mirror Books have quite a bit about the book online, but I think I'm going to build a separate Facebook page in the next day or two, with just kind of more detail, maybe more documents, things like that.
And after putting this book out, Sean, begs the question, what are you up to next?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm already researching a second book, which I'm hoping will be out next year. But, you know, somewhere in the same territory, let's say.
We look forward to speaking to you about that one. Sean O'Driscoll, author of The Accidental Spy, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Giles.